todos los que sabéis un poco de Rudowski, pues ya conocéis a Felicity. Ella es profesora y directora del programa Prácticas Críticas, Curatoriales y Conceptuales de la Arquitectura en la Universidad de Columbia, en lo que es la Escuela de Posgrado de Arquitectura, Planeamiento y Conservación en la ciudad de Nueva York. Tenemos que decir que ella desde finales del siglo XX comenzó esta seducción, ¿no? Cayó en esta seducción investigadora de Bernard Rudowski, publicando artículos como Underneath Aesthetics and Utility, que ya es del año 99. Yo también destacaría su capítulo en el libro de Mead Press, Experimentación en la cultura arquitectónica de posguerra, en la cual ella titula su trabajo Alegorías del nomadismo y del habitar en la obra de Bernard Rudowski. Y, por supuesto, su trabajo, que ha sido objeto de la prestigiosa beca de la Graham Foundation, con la cual ha sido capaz de recoger su tesis doctoral en torno a la figura rudowskiana y, presentarnos este libro que todos estamos esperando a que salga, ya está en la editorial, Cartografías de la deriva, Encuentros de Bernard Rudowski con la modernidad. Por supuesto, otros libros tratando en todo este mundo complejo de las genealogías de compromiso político y teórico, articulados con cuestiones de transformación tecnológica de la arquitectura moderna y contemporánea, que son, el nudo gordiano del trabajo de Felicity Scott. Por último, destacar sus libros también, Arquitectura o Tecnotopia, del año 2007, también del Mead Press. Ese libro que ahora también está preparando en Berlín, Outlawed Territories, Environments of Insecurity, también será de una lectura muy recomendada. Bueno, pues pasarle la palabra a Felicity. It's a pleasure, an honor. You're here today with us, Felicity. So we are eager to listen how you are going to focus on instruments for living. Thank you very much, Felicity.
Okay, thank you very much for that kind introduction. And I really just wanted to begin by thanking both Yolanda Romero and Marilyn for the invitation to speak here today at this very timely reassessment of Bernard Rudowski. And so I was asked to speak specifically on the American post-war period and Rudowski's reflections on modernity. And I had initially planned, as you mentioned, I've changed my title, I'd initially planned to touch on some exhibitions and some smaller publications in which Rudowski took American capitalism as his target, and he would, of course, make his points through witty inversions of commonplace beliefs regarding the American way of life. But when I received the program a few weeks ago, I thought it might be better to focus on Rudowski's very polemical reading of The American House. I think it serves as a rather surprising counterpoint to his interest in pre-industrial vernaculars, and also to his own work as a designer of modern houses. And so we'll be looking at a very different vernacular, a mid-20th century American vernacular, with which Rudowski had a very, very different relationship. To begin, on April 13th, 1945, Bernard Rudowski received a letter from Paul Theobald indicating his company's interest in publishing Our Clothes Modern. The book derived from his first exhibition at MoMA, called Our Clothes Modern, of 1944, and it addressed the paradoxical and distinctly unmodern, or in his terms, primitive forces at work in contemporary fashion. Alongside noting his acceptance, Rudowski jotted down a note, idea of second book, Our Houses Modern. Well, Theobald later confirmed his interest in having first option on Our House as Modern, Radovsky's proposed study on the house did not materialize, strictly speaking, as a sequel to his reflections on clothing. Our House as Modern, in fact, never appeared, but his notes for the project detail a conceptual framework that underlies his subsequent books, particularly Behind the Picture Window of 1955 and Architecture Without Architects of 1964. Radovsky's musing on the house from the late 1940s to the mid-50s, which is what I'm going to look at today, do follow on from Our Clothes Modern in many ways, demonstrating Radovsky's conflicted relation to contemporary architecture and the way of life that it sponsored. The more evidently architectural tropes at play also offer important clues for decoding his better-known work of the 1960s, like Architecture Without Architects. For we find ourselves at a complex and fascinating, if at times quite disturbing, nexus of militarization, mechanization, commodification, mobility, and domesticity, and faced with concerns about behavioral control, scientism, surveillance mechanisms, and the rise of new information technologies. So these are earlier studies for the cover. Published by Oxford University Press, the front matter to Behind the Picture Window announced that the author's original title was Uncle Sam's Cabin, a rather tactless reference, of course, to Harriet Beecher Stowe's famous 1852 anti-slavery novel, Uncle Sam's Cabin, or Life Among the Lowly. At first glance, Radovsky's book on the mid-century American house, which had the subtitle, An Unconventional Book on the Conventional Modern House and the Inscrutable Ways of Its Inmates, appears simply to offer a parody of suburban dwellings and their enslavement to a culture of consumption. Not unlike Our Clothes Modern, it demonstrated very few overt references or connections to architectural debates and received virtually no attention from the architectural community. Yet in retrospect, when read in association with other documents, Behind the Picture Window appears to be vectored with some precision as a critique of the forces impacting modern architecture, particularly the rapidly transforming technological environment, emergent techniques of environmental control, and the rising interest among architects in the human and social sciences. For Radovsky, all of these ideas spoke to the ongoing militarization and normative control of domestic environments, and they had significant effects on what he called the inmate, like the prisoner, yeah, the inmate of the American house. Of the American child, he remarked, for instance, and I quote, their vision is television. The first message that reaches them is not nature's, but the radio announcer's. So close reading of Radovsky's analysis of the house during this period suggests that his primary concern was to disclose and critique the impact of those forces of modernity upon architecture, and hence upon the bodies and psyches of its inhabitants. In this sense, his answer to the rhetorical question, are houses modern, were certainly yes, if not in the terms that might be expected from a modern architect. The wager here is that Radovsky's witty mid-century prose and his populist humor offer symptomatic clues regarding what was at stake for the discipline of architecture in addressing the impact of those contemporary forces. For what Radovsky seems to have recognized, wittingly or unwittingly, knowingly or unknowingly, was the degree to which modern architecture, and with it the modern house, had become a vehicle for what Michel Foucault theorized a few decades later as anatopolitical and biopolitical techniques of power, or biopower, to which I'll return, although Radovsky did not, of course, use such theoretical language. He recognized, as we shall see, that architecture played a role within emergent forms of governance, and that, the house was perhaps the most intimate and hence most powerful site through which such historical forces and forms of power were manifest. Radovsky's work, then, on the American house, thus serves here as an occasion to ask how, at this historical moment, did architecture interface with and become connected to this expanded nexus of political power? Through what means and to what ends was power invested in architecture, particularly the house? So the earliest, and these are of course from his earlier book on clothes, the earliest prospectus entitled Are Houses Modern, and his working title will change a number of times, is dated to February 23, 1947. And it indicates that Radovsky initially conceived the book in a very close and reciprocal dialogue with Are Clothes Modern. It opened with a section, What is a House? Analogy to Garments, overtly desublimating the architectural subtext of Are Clothes Modern. Yeah, so they're going back and forth. He's in dialogue between clothing and architecture. As with that first book, Radovsky did not intend to provide a how-to guide for or a conventional account of a virtuous modern house or a functional design. For example, under the title Decoration, he ominously listed ancestral home and Heimatsliebe, the German term, and blood and soil, alluding to the recent history of German fascism and suggesting that, as in the case of garments, essentialist claims regarding the symbolism of a house and by extension the identity of its occupants could be associated with or mobilized by pernicious ideologies. Aware of the degree to which the contemporary house, particularly in America, had been co-opted in turn by capitalism and served as a mechanism for environmental control, he went on to identify the sites, techniques, and technologies driving this form of regulation. So early outlines for Our Houses Modern return us to the themes from one of his texts from Domus in 1938, called The End of the City, Fin della Città, offering evidence of the degree to which Radovsky's thinking during the 1950s remained haunted by war and human unsettlement, as much as by his encounter with post-war America as an immigrant. Among his suggested lines of inquiry, we find, and I quote, migratory trends in history and modern time, insecurity and its relation to war making, the limits of modern hospitality, moving day, shelter, not industry, the main target in modern war, and density of population and dispersion. A 1948 version added Hiroshima, cave dwellers, Maginot Line, updating the nature of the perceived threats of attack from the air to include atomic bombs. Finally, the most developed outline in Radovsky's archive added stress on the question of mechanization and commodification. Entitled, a long title, A Tentative Outline of a Book on Human Shelter in General and on the Contemporary House in Particular, but chiefly about man in his role as inhabitant, its proposed topics included, and I quote, present state of the house, and pernicious idea of infinite progress, the house as a machine for living, the shop-built house, freedom from thought, immigrants in the new environment, and return to primitive dwelling types, Buckminster Fuller House, Nissen and Quonset huts, all military domestic technologies. Its final section, called the imponderables, the unknowables, ended on a more positive note. It was to be dedicated to the pursuit of happiness and would cover what he called the pleasures of the five senses. This is an image from Architects Without Architects that continues this theme. Anyway, it would cover the pleasure of the five senses, voluptuousness of ownership, love affair with a house, hedonism versus asceticism, experience unlimited. To differing degrees, all of these thematics would play out both in Behind the Picture Window and in the following decade, if less visibly, in Architecture Without Architects. So when Radovsky began his 1947 outline for Our Houses Modern with the question, what is a house? He was likely referring to a famous article from the July 1944 issue of Arts and Architecture, a California magazine. Compiled by John Entenza, Charles Eames, and Herbert Matter, What is a House set out to encourage the post-war adoption of wartime fabrication techniques for housing. In so doing, it offered an unbridled veneration of American industrial might or industrial power born of war, what the authors called real power through the machine, attempting to translate practices developed under emergency conditions into normative standards for architecture. Adopting a rhetoric of urgency, not atypical of war, they argued, and I quote, "We now know that the miracle of industry in war can and must be part of a peacetime world, a reality no longer possible to deny. An insistent power, so much part of the very existence of modern life, that we can no longer have the privilege of choosing whether or not we care to live with it, with warfare, with wartime technology, because by the very nature of progress, it has become a part of ourselves and the means by which we will live with one another." End of quote. So war, the authors announced, overlooking its associated violence, demonstrated possibilities of abundance through industry. Its legacy in techniques of mass production could save lives, this is their language, even set them free. The article might have given Radofsky pause, especially since comments made by these recent acquaintances at first appear to be in line with his own thinking. "We have restricted and limited the house's use as an instrument for living by forcing it into styles," the authors explained, adding, "we have actually submitted the house to the kind of thoughtless faddism with which we accept the season's fashion in hats." Yeah, so they're again making this analogy to clothing. Central to the argument of what is a house was that architects needed, and I quote, "to restudy, to redefine, and to readjust some of our obsolete attitudes toward living standards and means of distribution in order to profit from the enormous acceleration of world industry for military purposes," end of quote. Their key insight, one avowedly indebted to Buckminster Fuller, was that housing could be temporary, even mobile. They also proposed that architects shift their attention from industrial technology to electronic equipment, heralding the discipline's engagement with post-industrial technologies in the decades to come. And I quote, "Under the war pressure of an immediate life and death need for electronic equipment for use in radar communication controls and industrial techniques, an enterprise rivaling the size of the pre-war automobile industry has been developed. Only on such a scale of production is it now possible to anticipate that things like television will become a reality to the small house, but the development of electronics can and will be expanded far beyond its extensive service in battle and in war industry. It will mean, in the immediate future, precision control for hot-cold, light-dark, moist-dry, fast-slow, start-stop, plus health and service miracles of which we are just becoming aware." Yeah, so absolutely pro-military. So finally, echoing Buckminster Fuller's emphasis on scientific dwelling machines, architects were counseled to forget past design practices and pursue instead scientific tools and methodologies in order to better understand the house and its inhabitants. In addition to time and motion studies like these, by then familiar to modern architects from the research of Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, what is a house stressed detailed study of human behavior under categories like circulation, space, environment, health, storage problems, and psychological desires. So assuming the rationality of scientific method, such data collection on human behavior would ensure architects' intimate knowledge of contemporary modes of life, and hence the possibility of effectively putting that knowledge to work within what those authors called the environment that conditions us. In other words, the house. Armed with such knowledge, architects could generate more efficient instruments for shelter, simultaneously benefiting industry and instituting models of environmental conditioning. Situated at the intersection of life, habitation, science, knowledge, and power, here we find ourselves at the very nexus of Foucault's incisive reading of how, within contemporary forms of government, life itself had become the subject of political and economic strategy. As What is a House indicated, seemingly without apology, new economic and technical potentials born of war harbored political imperatives. Science in industry, they ominously wrote, cannot be expected to function if it must make compromises in terms of political minorities, commitments to the past, prejudices concerning the future. So Radovsky might well have flinched here as well. As he hauntingly remarked in the closing pages of Our Close Modern, and I quote, minorities have always been unpopular. So by contrast, Radovsky refused to embrace the stamp of war. In wartime, or as we've been accustomed to call it, in time of emergency, he wrote with resignation in the early 1950s, the human mind of the individual is substituted by the military mind. So Radovsky did, however, share the behaviorist conception of domestic space as the environment that conditions us. In The Inmate, this was another prospectus for his book on the house, he presented dwellings as, and I quote, tangible evidence of a philosophy of life, describing his topic as the house we live in and our way of life as far as it is shaped by the house. Behavior is, broadly speaking, he speculated in the 1950s, reaction and response to environment. Among civilized people, the environment is mostly man-made, he continued. Among it, the house plays a preponderant part. More than heredity, more than any single factor, the house, it seems, shapes the individual. Long before the child enters school, his dominant habits have emerged, end of quote. So Radovsky's speculations regarding behavioral conditioning through domestic environments and what type of instrument the house might become depart radically, as we'll see, from Eames and Tenzer and Matter. To him, something had gone awry, something had gone wrong in the very conception of relations between a house and its inhabitants. Cause and effect had been inverted. Contemporary American houses, rather than reflecting culture, served as tools of behaviorist-oriented social engineering, operating as technologies through which to write micro-political logics onto the body of their occupants. It seems possible, Radovsky argued, that the concept of the house as the basic factor determining behaviors involves a confusion of historical sequence in the development of human society. Yeah, so he's arguing that behavioral science was now driving progress, this unfolding of the house. So while presented in lighthearted prose in Behind the Picture Window, Radovsky's questioning of technology retained a troubled, but not simply technophobic valence in unpublished writing. So he's not against technology. Mechanization, he wrote on his Olivetti typewriter, was not a new phenomena. Machines of all sorts were known in ancient times. Man, he said, conceived his first tools as extensions of his hands. So for Radovsky, following Lewis Mumford, the problem arose when those tools found new and more powerful sources of energy, from harnessing animals to burning coal and oil to deploying atomic energy, hence expanding their domain. So man made his crucial error, Radovsky posited, when he failed to stop at mechanizing his manual tasks and began subordinating his entire existence to a mechanical scheme. With the introduction of what he called labor-saving methods into the intimacy of the house, man the master, he contended, had become enslaved to technological devices to detrimental ends. Speaking to this sort of entropic temporality, this temporality that had gone wrong, he continued, and I quote, there is a line of development, at times straight, at others tortuous, of what we have been used to calling, somewhat incautiously, progress. It took some time before we realized that this sort of progress is not limitless, that the limit is neatly circumscribed by the peculiar makeup of human nature. At times, we flattered ourselves that our complexion could be changed under the impact of mechanical devices and that unbridled progress would produce superhumans. This is not the case. we cannot help paying a steep price for every conquest in terms of human substance, whether corporeal or spiritual. End of the quote. So pathologizing this question further, Radovsky went on to lament the parasitic growth of gadgets that has infested everyday life has not yet been diagnosed as a malady, though we may very well resign ourselves that it is an unhealthy symptom whose ultimate consequences have not been felt. Yeah, so he's imagining the sort of endpoint of this technology. So North Americans, Radovsky believed, were particularly prone to allowing mechanization to expand into every crevice of their existence, something he attributed in part to historical circumstance. Am I quoting him here? He said, as it happens, the time of the most intense colonization of the continent of North America coincided with the rise of industrialism in Europe. Hence, in the United States, obstacles such as sentimentality or artisanal expertise did not, as he put it, stand in the way of the full exploitation of these new powers. To this, Radovsky added, in a portentous tone, we have not yet reached the end of mechanization, and therein lies the danger, perhaps the greatest threat to life itself. So here, Radovsky was overtly citing Lewis Mumford's Techniques and Civilization. He cited Mumford's point that modern industrialism may equally be termed a large-scale military operation, silently inverting Mumford's original framing. So Mumford had referred to the complacent characterization of the First World War, that it was a large-scale industrial operation, yeah, when it was actually war. So faced with an ever-expanding reach of technologies derived from military research into the domestic domain, Radovsky reacted in a manner antithetical to that suggested by Intenza, Eames, and Madder. He rejected its normalizing mandate, and in so doing, provided some very insightful readings of the impact of this phenomena. So in the context of noting Mumford's analogies between humans and machines, from the fabrication of lifelike automata during the Enlightenment, to the reduction of humans to what he called bare mechanical elements subsumed within industrial systems, Radovsky came up with the suggestion, compare with Le Corbusier's machine à habiter, machine for living. So TypeScript note expanded on what might be at stake in this comparison. And I quote, some 20 years ago, Le Corbusier coined the famous epigram, the house is a machine for living. Its effect on a large part of the public was explosive, and it brought him more notoriety than all of his architectural work, the grip which it held on the imagination of people who had never been interested in problems of architecture is an indication that it had touched on a sentiment that heretofore had been submerged in the unconscious. Every sort of distrust directed previously in an inarticulate way against 20th century art, music, and literature, he continued, found a more tangible and familiar target in the emergence of the modern house. In the pioneering countries like Germany and Holland, emotional objections outweighed practical ones. The flat roof, for instance, a feature common to those earliest buildings, was condemned not as an unsatisfactory technical detail, but as incompatible with the blood and soil mysticism, which at the time was gaining impetus and later culminated in Nazism. End of quote. So recalling that the flat roof status as an important symbol of internationalism, recalling that it was a symbol of internationalism, Radovsky argued that the famous 1927 Weissenhof Siedlungen exhibition in Stuttgart that you see here, designed by Mies van der Rohe, was the first large-scale experiment where the characteristics of machines for living were displayed. Too valuable to be torn down by the Hitler regime, Radovsky continued, noting that a supplement had been added in attempt to revive German national identity, every one of the houses received a perfectly superfluous pitched or gabled roof. And I don't have a picture, but he's suggesting that they tried to fix them up. So architectural modernism in America faced distinct challenges in Radovsky's assessment. Not only were houses more fully integrated into infrastructural networks like water gas, and electricity, they were also the byproducts of desires manufactured by dominant systems of communication that simultaneously served as systems of administration. If, as Radovsky put it, Le Corbusier needed nothing more than a well-functioning machine for shelter, this was not the case for the quintessential inhabitant of the American house. And I quote Radovsky, "The person to whom the agonies of living are mitigated through the nursing aid of columnists, analysts, book club, radio, and television. Such a person," Radovsky noted, "needs the administration of the interior decorator." So in this context, he went on, he once again returned to this cross-Atlantic analogy between blood and soil ideology and Nazi Germany and commercialism in the US. Yeah, so he's going back and forth, this time with recourse to the figure of nomadism, a trope that would be central to his work of the 1960s. "So it seems to me," Radovsky remarked, of his adopted country, "that the current concept of the house is nomadic." And I quote again, "The Western non-peasant house is the wagon of steppes," like steppes we see on the left here, "in 1001 Metamorphoses. It never pretends to have roots like the peasant house. It is non-personal and non-anchored. It would be very helpful indeed to find different words for the two different phenomena, the shelter of the sedentarian," you know, the person that stays in one place, "and the shelter of the nomad," the person who moves. "I propose, at least for this discussion," Radovsky stated, "that the peasant house be called hereafter the house, while the other type that services the nomad, the wanderer, the commuter, the pioneer, the migrant, and just every restless individual of our time, the home," end of quote. So opposing then the autochthonous peasant house to what he called the non-personal, non-anchored home, he went on to note, "In the 20th century, the concept of the home as a native place is an absurdity." So unpacking this home-house distinction further, he clarified, "At first this might sound like a bad pun, a bad joke. Is not, you might ask, the term home more adequate to the peasant dwelling rooted in the soil? Does not home signify the native place? But herein lies the trap. Associated with primitive inhabitations, not subject to fashion, dwellings, as he put it, without telephone, car garage, radio, television, automatic kitchens and bathroom, the term house, he proposed, had become an anachronism within modernity. By contrast, what he referred to as that frail box, which serves as shelter to the majority of my countrymen in America, a box which might be put on wheels and moved to another location, this collapsible commodity is called today by almost everyone home." So Radovsky then went on, sort of ambiguously collapsing these key terms of house and home, and I quote, "The ultimate, though not necessarily definite type of modern house, the modern house of the nomad, is the trailer. Here is truly the most logical sort of shell for modern man. No trace of the cumbersome house." And he's being ironic, yes, of course, he's being parodic. "Instead, a cornucopia on wheels filled to the brim with later-day blessings of mechanization. The common garden, or rather empty lot variety, is still to some degree earthbound. It comes with a sort of umbilical cord to be plugged in to an electric outlet. It is no doubt merely a matter of time until the last link with the soil will wither." End of quote. So home in America, that is, was no longer a native place, but a transient instrument for dwelling, its nomadic potential distinctly at risk of becoming recuperated within the capitalist system, reterritorialized by commercializing imperatives and their key target, in this case, the purchase of new, electrically powered, mechanical equipment. So, to come to his book. So this question of mechanization was the dominant theme within Behind the Picture Window. But Radovsky rarely disclosed these underlying concerns, you know, what he saw as the ramifications of mechanization. He simply promised his readers a sober inspection of our domestic habits and their precipitate, the habitation. Radovsky alluded twice to Le Corbusier's famous dictum from Towards an Architecture of 1923, the house is a machine for living, albeit he never mentioned Le Corbusier by name. Questions of militarization, of nomadism, and commodification also surface in many guises. Looking not only beneath the surface of his discourse, but also, he believed, within American domesticity, these issues continued to drive his critical stakes, as manifest in the book's 9 chapters, dedicated in order to cooking, eating, the chair, music, the bed, bathing, outdoor rooms, mechanical contraptions, and surveillance. Each investigated forces of habituation and social control, informing life in the post-war American house, in order to offer a picture of the relationship between habits, domestic habits, the inhabitant, the person, and inhabitation. More specifically, Radovsky's aim was to chart desires or perceived needs that were perpetuated by capitalism, written upon the body and psyche of the subject, what he called the inmate, and inscribed within the organization and equipment of the house. So Radovsky presented behind the picture window as a risky but necessary intervention into myths sustaining the American way of life. Risky since, as he put it, a critic not confined to the pages of magazines was dismissed as a social misfit or as an agent of the enemy, and he's referring to communism. Not only is it hard to think freshly about the house, he wrote, and I quote, to do so may appear sacrilegious to the devout, to whom the question of what the house should be seems redundant. In everyday practice, the prevailing economic factors, our customs, and to an increasing degree, the fashions of the day determine automatically the nature of the house, he proposed. Deviations from accepted norms are seen as a breach of etiquette, or worse, as an antisocial act. What in the old days, he concluded, was loosely referred to as the vase of life has become, in our time, a solemn shrine from the American way of life, end of quote. Recalling yet further polemics about the fashion industry from Arklow's Modern, he argued that the canonization of the house was a paradoxical effect of the logic of perpetual obsolescence. To prevent dissatisfaction with creature comforts, we have come to rely on change, he wrote, and I quote again, before we get to know what is ailing us, the object of our discomfort has been conjured away, and a new one has taken its place. On the strengths of advertising or hearsay, we throw away perfectly serviceable commodities, automobiles, wives, or statesmen for new and untried ones. Change becomes a promissory note on happiness, and because of its short-term nature, it fits ideally into our fast-moving world, end of quote. So the promesse de bonheur of modern life, that is, had become merely a promissory note, payable at a later date. Furthermore, Radovsky stressed repeatedly that such progress entailed the loss of sensuality and erotic charge, the very qualities he hoped to reinstate in his architecture, and which he believed to offer a line of flight from normative mandates. We neither ask nor expect from the bath benefits of a sensual nature, he lamented. The bathroom is a purely mechanical arrangement. The contemporary bed, too, was, as he put it, charged with eroticism no more than a refrigerator. So in a chapter called The Ballast of the House, and ballast refers to like the material or weight that balances a ship or another vehicle, in this chapter, he turned to address what he called the cancerous growth of household equipment. The desire to accumulate such equipment, he posited, was not about keeping a household going. Far from it. It was not at all functional in orientation. Its acquisition was, like clothing, primarily of social and psychological importance. And I quote, if the batteries of gadgets and mechanical tools turn out to be less useful than expected, they more than compensate by their very presence, which stands for normalcy and solvency, if, as so often, only on the installment plan. The social prestige alone, which goes with owning mechanical equipment, is worth their purchase. Today, he continued, buying is not only one of the strongest forms of self-assertion, it's an unfailing stratagem to integrate oneself within the community, as Lewis Mumford put it, in a society that knows no other ideals. Spending becomes the chief source of delight. Finally, it amounts to a social duty, end of quote. So hence this sort of irrational defense of purchasing equipment in America. To question the benefits of what is commonly called the fine array of labor-saving aids is heresy, Radofsky asserted again. Not only a sign of good citizenship, spending on such items, as with clothing, also marked a subject as modern. Reiterating Adolf Loos, the Austrian architect's remark, that one is modernly dressed when one stands out the least, Radofsky proposed, and I quote, the eagerness to attain the status of the ideal consumer, the desire to merge socioeconomically with the crowd, compares to the desire for the security and anonymity accorded by the convent. It makes you invisible, means you don't stand out. So another aspect of modern design that Radofsky lambasted or ridiculed was the embrace of paradigms of scientific rationalization and household management, as famously codified for modern architecture in 1929 as existence minimum, minimum existence, at CM2 in Frankfurt. As Radofsky scoffed of the impact of such paradigms, our houses became laboratories. Identifying with scientists, architects, he satirically posited, and I quote, studied the house's lifelines, its clogged arteries, its frayed nerves. He applied his curiosity to life at home in the hope of finding ways to reduce human activities to an absolute minimum. Alluding to the Gilbreths, whose work we saw before, and to figures like Margaret Schütte-Lehotsky's, her famous Frankfurt kitchen that you see on the right, Radofsky Riley noted that architects now drew diagrams and imaginary traffic lines, shifting their plane of concern from the aesthetic or representational dimension of architecture to a horizontal dimension through which flows of bodies were organized and regulated. As he put it, and I quote, architects conducted endurance tests in order to find the point where men go out of their minds and revert to a happier animal existence. Some with a scientific frame of mind become obsessed with labor, with saving ever so minute quantities of human energy. They developed ingenious ways to photograph such routine performances as changing a shirt or preparing breakfast to find weak spots and save a second here, an inch there. Among the better known results of their concerted efforts, if not exactly in the manner envisioned by them, was a kitchen where one could do all one's work sitting down. Yeah, so here he's referring to Lihotzky's kitchen. It inaugurated a new sedentary way of life. Even contraptions for physical exercise were built to accommodate a seated person, end of quote. So in the end, he concluded of what he called these diligent studies, dating them to the interwar period and marking a persistent breach between architecture and science. He said it was an aesthetic movement in the end, a minor upheaval preceding the birth of so-called modern architecture. So Radofsky returned in other chapters to thematics that Foucault had identified with the emergence of the calculated management of life within modernity. Radofsky referred, for instance, to the sterilizing impact of the physician's work, what he called the guardians of our health, on bathing, eating, and other matters. As evidence, Radofsky ironically invoked an 18th century German motion machine invented for motive therapy, as well as the medical invention of an early Italian doctor, Sertorius, who had developed a dining chair to manage the intake of food. The chair was equipped, as he explained, with a built-in weighing machine, which at the critical swallow would tip the scales and throw the diner out of reach of his food, and you see this on the right. If you ate too much, the seat would move away. Speaking to the ethos of the scientific house designer, Radofsky even recalled a report on the kitchen that dealt solely with value patterns, motivation-energy relationships, acoustics, and workers' oxygen consumption, but nowhere mentioned cooking. In the course of treatment, The kitchen, he explained, had acquired a sociological complexion and was called, depending upon one's point of view, an inclination, a work center, a social center, the core of the house, or the food laboratory. And so he's laughing at this shift in rhetoric. Promising ever more advanced forms of the care of the body, an increasingly medicalized concept of the house emerged. But its correlate was not simply health. As Radovsky put it, the relapse into our dismal ways of bathing would be less deplorable had we not also lost the liberal attitude toward the object of care, our body. This attitude, he believed, had come to pervade architecture. Architects, he wrote, dispense no patent medicines. They work like physicians on an individual basis, but sometimes the architect throws in psychiatric surveillance, aptitude tests, and occupational therapy. End of quote. Now I'm skipping over a bit of my talk here. I know I'm going to go long. So behind the picture window, focus primarily on this so-called ballast or mechanical equipment, on chairs, tables, kitchen gadgets, bathtubs, etc., along with the scientific research, etiquette manuals, and advertising techniques driving its consumption and establishing social norms. But three chapters stand out as pursuing different stakes, one called Every Room a Music Room, one called The Conditioned Outdoor Room, and one called On Boredom and Disprivacy, and I just want to go through each of these quickly. So despite its innocuous title, Every Room a Music Room is, I think, the most remarkable, articulating the shift from a predominantly industrial milieu to a post-industrial one. In the first instance, the chapter outlines the evolution from what Radovsky called an old-fashioned, handmade type of music to an industrial product, purged of its impurities and inconsistencies, arranged, adapted, and monitored, then dispensed as the musico-pharmaceutical product, functional music. In the second instance, however, and invoking the language of doses, medication, and treatment, Radovsky spoke of a type of music which, when properly administered, accomplishes specific predetermined ends other than entertainment or pleasure. So in this context, he cited Charles M. Dizerens, a pioneer in the art of influencing people with music, and I quote, "The physician, the doctor, who applies music as a therapeutic agent must be acquainted with the patient's manner of life, knowledge, character, temperament, passions, habits, musical training, and musical aptitudes in order to predict and control response to music with any degree of success. In the absence of such control, undesirable psychological changes may be induced." End of quote. Music, too, that is to say, emerged as one more technique to regulate behavior, a technique of power born of the ever more intimate knowledge of the human subject and his or her way of life. Functional music was not also, as Radovsky insisted, again complicating linear narratives of progress, an invention of the contemporary sound engineer. Its positive effects as a sleep agent, a dietary agent, a romantic or lactating agent, these are his terms, like a milk agent, and even as a supposed curative element for deafness or mental illness had long been speculated upon. Music also enjoyed, as he recalled, hence my images, a long history of deployment within military strategy. After proposing that bugle calls and military anthems were thought to translate into muscular energy and that battle music was relied upon to arouse homicidal tendencies called martial ardor, he added, "Even more rewarding than the use of music as a psychological weapon was its employment as ammunition. The industrialization of musical techniques and their coordination with medical science," Radovsky dated to World War I. "Their redeployment in the civilian domain arising thereafter." Returning to the theme of translating wartime technology into post-war lifestyles, he added satirically that singer Maud Ilson, who's my earlier image, her musical pharmaceutical talents were redirected after the war to make music the greatest possible instrument for Americanization, for socialization of American commodity culture. Equally troubling for Radovsky were recent studies by cool-headed scientists, they're his words, working at the Music Research Foundation, an institute, as he put it, well-endowed with funds and military blessing, and at the time statistically evaluating, organizing, and storing musical work for medical purposes. Their Capurso study attempted to categorize music by the emotional effects it could induce when applied. So Radovsky's target here was not music, but the ever-increasing inroads or invasion of communication technologies into the domestic space and the systems of power that they served. Right from the start, he identified forms of unwitting resistance or counter-productivity emerging during this encounter with new musical technologies. This, he suggested, became evident following a person's overexposure to industrial music, especially when repetition becomes a thousandfold, as on the radio, or through playback technologies like phonographs or sound recordings. Such repetition, he posited, led to immunity, numbness, or dimming of the listener's receptive faculties. Radovsky went on to speculate that this sort of foreclosure to the onrush of communication could serve, in fact, as a form of protection or defense. And I quote, Henry James once observed that the faculty of attention has utterly vanished from the Anglo-Saxon mind. One might say that inattention has its good points. In our time, it has taken on an innate protective quality, much like the ability to regulate our bloodstream and body temperature. Without the capacity for inattention, our sensibility, or what's left of it, would long have disintegrated under the continuous onrush of uncalled for communications, end quote. So that it was possible then to deploy communication overload, this sort of inattentiveness to other ends, was a theme Radovsky returned to later in the decade, or later decades. In this context, he offered a more remarkable story to make his point. "This is as good a place as any," he wrote, "to remember an unsung pioneer, if not of television proper, of its therapy, J. Leonard Corning, M.D. Bringing together experimental techniques of optic and acoustic bombardment, Corning, as Radovsky put it, sought to find an inexpensive and antitoxic remedy against thinking. He was, it seems, the first to use an admixture of moving pictures and sounds in therapy." There, Radovsky's words. A late 19th century medical doctor, Corning had developed experiments with a proto-cinematic device to produce a carefully controlled audiovisual stimulus. His equipment was ingenious but simple, Radovsky recounted. The patient, and you see it drawing, the patient donned an acoustical hood resembling the headgear sported in recent times by spacemen. It had built-in earphones that were connected with an Edison phonograph in an adjacent room. A vertical rectangular screen and an electronically operated projector may easily be recognized as the forerunners of our television set. A couch for the subject, as the doctor preferred to call his patient, completed the arrangement. End of quote. So housed in a darkened space, this apparatus channeled the subject's attention simultaneously through what he called harmonic vibrations, through sound, that penetrated their mind through the acoustical hood, which also served to bracket out other environmental noise, hence controlling the input, the data input, and through the flow of stereopticon images projected on the screen. As Radovsky pointed out, any visual pleasure produced was simply a byproduct of the procedure, not its aim. It's deeper, and I quote Radovsky, its deeper effects began to be felt by the patient only after his power of attention had been exhausted. So it was this condition then of fatigue and drowsiness, according to Corning, a state which is half sleep, half waking. It was in this state that the musical waves surging into the labyrinth and onward to the sensorium produced effects alike transcendent and indescribable. So Radovsky goes on to say, fortunately for us, the effects were not entirely indescribable, having been recounted or recorded as a case history in Corning's pamphlet. And I quote, "A typical case
is M, study case M, the letter M, a young man of philosophical disposition whose nerves were not what they should have been and who suffered from a variety of symptoms. But let Dr. Corning have the word, and then he's quoting Corning. Depressing ideas obtrude themselves at irregular intervals and with implacable obstinacy during the whole time of waking. What is the meaning of life? What is the use of living? I caused him to look frequently at the images in the device, relates the doctor. After frequent exercise, he declared that during the persistence of the phenomena, the musical pictures, he was unable to think and remained quite free from imperative ideas. Intense treatment restored M's peace of mind, and henceforth, Dr. Corning goes on to say, whenever his patient was assailed by philosophical thoughts, he would immediately call up the color images and their harmonic associates, whose vivid recollection was sufficient to put a quick termination to the unwelcome intrusion, end of quote. Yeah, so critical then to this enchantment, recognized by Corning, was that the apparatus served to eradicate all thoughts from the subject. Even inattentiveness was recuperable for medical applications. Radovsky's target was, of course, as he stated, television, a device increasingly prevalent in American homes during the 1950s. Unlike the unfortunate late 19th century subject, M, he wryly noted, for contemporary inmates of suburban America, prophylactic treatment is available to us at home at all hours. A mere glance at a house, Radovsky remarked, alluding to the ubiquity of television antennas, tells us whether the health of its inhabitants is safeguarded. One is inclined to feel, Radovsky concluded, that never again will there be a subject too sick to ask, what is the use of living? Or for that matter, what is the use of a living room? So the conditioned outdoor room, more briefly, this chapter returned to the courtyard or patio house that had so preoccupied Radovsky during the 1930s and early 1940s. Asking, is North America inhabitable? Radovsky parodied attempts to conquer climate. Climate cannot be conquered like redcoats and redskins. It does not surrender or vanish, he proposed, invoking the violence of war and colonization. One either lives with it or remains to it a stranger, garrisoned and forever on the defensive. So contrasting his ambitions to live within the American environment, to life within the American environment, through the use of a courtyard house, rather than to seal oneself off against it, Radovsky invoked the 17th century Plymouth, like an early American settlement, as a pre-industrial form of stockade that had, as he put it, all the aspects of a penal colony. Asserting that enclosing walls were now unpopular, and I just show the image he used, this image on the front cover for one of his designs, pencil points. Asserting that enclosing walls were now unpopular in the US, except for their use in convents and prisons, and that they were considered pathological, Radovsky wryly remarked, but then it's difficult to improve on barbed wire. So Radovsky's point was not to pillory or ridicule enclosed outdoor spaces, or what he called rooms without ceilings, but to stress that there were important distinctions to be made in how and against what one protected oneself from the outside world. Noting that ancient examples of outdoor rooms excavated in Pompeii communicated instead a sense of comfort, a unique sense of comfort, he suggested that the more intimate type of space might participate in a revival of sensuous interest in the world around us, even help us to feel more at home under the sky. So the chapter was illustrated with Radovsky's designs for a courtyard house in Prochida. Sorry, but also with the Arnstein and Frontini houses in Sao Paulo in Brazil, and by two photographs of garden structures and outdoor rooms that he designed in 1949 for Constantino and Ruth Nivola, the Italian artist, and his wife's property in Amagansett, Long Island, New York. This project was one of only a few works that Radofsky built in the United States, and I want to look at it briefly here before returning to conclude with Behind the Picture Window. The Nivola complex was organized around a central paved cooking terrace, demarcated spatially by a red timber frame, within which sat a black and white painted brick fireplace, benches, and a chimney. Along with a series of other elements, like freestanding stucco-covered walls, geometrically precise wooden pergolas, statues of female forms, etc., distributed around the terrace was a white stucco-finished solarium, an enclosed and intensely private room without a roof, windows, or doors, accessed by a staircase only. Its external walls were painted with colorful murals by Tino Nivola. In October 1952, Radofsky had published an account of the project in Arts and Architecture, casting it as a celebration of the war and distancing his designs from the transparency and weightlessness more typical of modern architecture. He also spoke to the intimacy and ordering of the Wohngarten, garden, the living gardens of ancient times, for instance, those of Pompeii or Ostia, and wryly suggested that the more sensitive souls among the readers are perhaps aware that a wall has, apart from utilitarian and aesthetic values, a unique quality which radiates comfort far beyond and above bodily comfort. And these are the sensuous qualities that he sought in his work. So Radofsky not only stressed the intimacy of the outdoor spaces, but also the abstraction and modernity of the garden structures. Far from attempting to naturalize his additions to the landscape, he stressed the contrast between the non-utilitarian walls, what he called of the utmost precision and brilliant whiteness, and their environment. The pergola, he explained, is reduced to almost a linear design and does not intend to be more than abscissa and coordinate, yeah, Cartesian. For Radofsky, the space served as a framing or ordering device distinct from glass walls or even picture windows. And I quote, "The spectacle of the ever-changing sky can be truly enjoyed only out of doors. Viewing the sky through even the most generous expanse of plate glass is a poor substitute for the genuine article. It almost seems," he continued, "that the use of glass walls in recent years has alienated the garden. In some instances, the arrangement recalls a shop window. The garden has become, to borrow a word, a spectator garden." So by contrast, his outdoor rooms situated the viewer in an almost proto-cinematic way, and I quote him, "engendering a gratuitous and continuously changing spectacle of shadows and reflections which served," yeah, the walls were serving as projection screens for the surrounding plants. So it was only finally, so of course, Mises Farnsworth House and Philip Johnson's glass house. So it was only on boredom and disprivacy, the very last chapter, that Radofsky invoked the picture window appearing in the book's title. While glass houses remained, as he put it, the prerogative of the well-to-do, and many of his notes speak to Johnson's glass house and Mises' house, he goes on to remark that the underprivileged in America were forced to make do with an economy-sized picture window. Beyond a simple icon of suburban domesticity, the picture window appeared in his analysis as one among many surveillance techniques serving the American distrust of privacy and nonconformity. Modern life facilitates the supervision of the inmate considerably, he posited, of the picture window's panoptic qualities. Never much in demand, privacy was always thought of as a dangerous state, he argued. Tracing a somewhat apocryphal history of surveillance in the American context, from teething men employed to watch over 10 families in colonial times, to the transparency offered by the open plan and glass walls of modern office buildings, Radofsky presented the American house as a precipitate, that's his words, of a disciplinary and spectacular gaze that assured conformity. The picture window, he remarked, seldom affords a view of anything more picturesque than the picture window of one's neighbor. However, that visibility worked in both ways. It discloses, as he put it, it discloses to the passerby a glowing and carefully arranged picture of domesticity. Yeah, so he's just talking about this reciprocity. So at this point, Rudofsky's discourse shifted again from questions of spatial organization and transparency familiar to architectural modernism to those proper to post-industrial technologies, information devices. Surveillance, he posited, citing instances of translating wartime technologies into the domestic realm and undergone a recent transformation. No longer operating by sight, it now functioned remotely. Surveillance now functioned remotely, if more invasively, through electronic devices. And I quote him here, "The pocket recorder, a gadget heralded as of unparalleled usefulness," he wrote, "can be counted on to remove the last dregs of privacy from our lives." And I quote again, "Originally designed for the military and diplomatic service, diplomatic secret service, it enables everyone to strike out in a line of one's own murky practices, or strike out a line of one's own murky practices. It is without doubt a great improvement of the teething men," Rudofsky argued. "Just stick it in a pocket and pin a tiny mic under your lapel, or wear the facsimile wristwatch mic." He goes on, "The joyous exclamation point is theirs, not mine, and you can record the words of anything within about 20 feet. You simply put your hand in your pocket and flick a silent switch," end of quote. So imagining the emergence then of a form of counter-control in the face of such Cold War diplomatic technologies, Rudofsky asked what might happen if a person simply ceased to speak, like stopped talking, or otherwise interrupted the transparency of communication. And I quote, "Suppose we scatter all over the house a sort of anti-acoustic confetti that rumples the sound waves to thwart the Judas in our midst. But surely this would be quite impolite, and perhaps by then illegal," end of quote. So it was not, he concluded, citing the progressive judge, Judge Leonard Hand, who had fought McCarthyism. Rudofsky said it was not the outrageous who were dangerous, but the conforming. So on the final page of Behind the Picture Window, while discussing boredom, Rudofsky invoked Le Corbusier's dictum again, "The house is a machine for living." He emphasized not the machine, but the other key term of Adolf Lanz's famous 1853 remarks, remarks that were believed to be the source of Le Corbusier's use of this term, machine habitée. So he cited the term instrument. So would it not be possible, Lanz had proposed, to go even further and plan our buildings and houses by taking into account the person who frequents or inhabits them, not only to determine their general arrangements and distribution, but also to introduce thousands of specific comforts, services, and time and energy-saving devices that the adaptation of new procedures from science and industry could provide for domestic life. A house, Lanz proposed, is an instrument, a machine, so to speak, that not only serves as a shelter for man, but must conform to his activity and multiply the production of his work, end quote. So picking up on this term instrument, but redirecting its meaning away from labor-saving devices and away from the inscription of subjects within apparatuses of production, Rudofsky deployed its other resonance from within the domain of music to offer a panacea to mechanization. And I quote, "Assuming that in the future we shall be able to live the lives of humans," Rudofsky speculated, "the house of man will have to become once more an instrument for living instead of being a machine for living. This would make all the difference in our attitude, the difference between playing a violin and a jukebox." So this formulation of a house as an instrument for living had also appeared in Eames and Tenza and Matter's What is a House? Yet the instrument of which Rudofsky spoke was not the push-button device of military origin, but an old-fashioned contraption for making music. He returned many times to this formulation of the jukebox versus the violin. His point was, of course, that whereas the jukebox operated mechanically at the push of a button, playing a predetermined set of tunes, typically from a mainstream hit list, the violin implied a less automated subject, one that might use the equipment to produce their own sound in an untempered manner, tuning the instrument according to their own preference. Such an instrument, Rudofsky had earlier lamented, cannot give you satisfaction if you cannot play it. My point is that the finest house in the world won't mean a thing if you don't know how to live. So to conclude very quickly, I just have one more paragraph. As evident in Behind the Picture Window, Rudofsky's work during the late 1940s and the early 50s, and this goes on into the 60s, was marked by the experience of war and population displacement, as well as by new technologies, both industrial and informatic, and their role within the emerging Cold War matrix of power. The book also reiterated concerns from his period in Italy and Brazil, albeit redirected by his encounter with America. Years later, Rudofsky returned to many thematics that I've been tracing, the courtyard house, privacy, Mediterranean vernaculars, the picture window, atomic warfare, environmental catastrophe, science, progress, engineered obsolescence, computerization, along with references to modern architects like Philip Johnson and Mies. In 1964, the year of architecture without architects, he reviewed Community and Privacy Toward a New Architecture of Humanism, a book written by his friend Serge Chamayev in collaboration with a young fellow expatriate from Vienna, Christopher Alexander. Published in Domus, Rudofsky's review recovers his earlier study on the house to critical ends, implying that his ideas had been updated by new self-appointed critics, those equally willing to risk being labeled as unpatriotic, as misfits, or as maladjusted. He wrote, "Today, when most architects are preoccupied with structural and aesthetic acrobats, it is heartening to see two professional men engaged in re-examining something as unspectacular as the human habit and human habitation. Come to think of it," he added, "Chamayev and Alexander's plea for privacy amounts to nothing less than a plot to subvert their fellow citizens. But rather than scrutinizing our idiosyncrasies, the authors proceed to remedy them," Rudofsky lamented, distinguishing their book from his own provocations. Pointing to their practices of analysis, definition, structuring, tabulation, and their listing of requirements for dwelling, Rudofsky ironically quipped of such techno-scientific methods that their use of science and technology was quite lucid. Hence, he concluded, one is much surprised to find the American deus ex machina, the computer, invoked. Thank you.